Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. I usually surround myself with orange skies or sunshines or rainbows. This segment's going to be a little different, but it still will be brought to you by our friends at Fadley's, where we're going to enjoy those delicious crab cakes beginning on April 2nd. I'm about to do a crab cake tour with no ending, kind of like the parties on Kane Street back in the 80s. It will include crab cakes from Fadley's, my friends at Costas, on the 2nd of April. We're also going to be getting over to State Fair. Evan says, I have the best crab cake. Everyone says they have the best crab cake. I know they're going to have some great margaritas across the street over to El Guapo as well. Big appreciation to all of our sponsors, including Wise Markets coming in and educating us on nutrition. We're going to be doing a lot with them. Rob Santoni's coming on next week to talk about our partnership. We're changing intelligent conversation to wise conversation. Don Moeller is riding shotgun on this one. And I'll just say this before we bring Justin Fenton on. Moeller was so hot and bothered to get Fenton on, and it took him a couple weeks to get back. And as is sometimes the case, Don thought that because he worked at the Sun, I may have somehow found myself sideways, you know, being an alum. And I'm like, I have no beef with Justin Fenton. I read his work. I respect him. And I said, I hope he comes on. I hope we get him on. So, Don, you put this together, and I think it's more about family and time and all of this, but he's got a hell of a book. I don't know that you've ever been more prepared. That so Justin Moeller was my high school guidance counselor in 1982. Yours looks strangely like the Cliff Notes from a color scheme perspective. So, you know, he read the book, I read the Cliff Notes, but we own this city. Have you on, man?
Well, yeah, welcome Justin Fenton, Baltimore Sun, author of We Own This City, really the novel about the Gun Trace Task Force. Justin, welcome aboard.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Well, I've got to tell you that it's hard to know where to start. But before we get into all the serious stuff, you know, Nestor's been asking everyone, and we put him on the spot. It doesn't have to be one of our sponsors. If you had a friend come to town and they said, I want you to take me to get the best Maryland crab cake, where would you be taking your friends, Justin?
So I do. Fadley's is my go-to answer. I love the atmosphere at Fadley's. I love the crab cakes. But I have to also say, a year or two ago had G&M, and I have to say that. I mean, I've never had a crab cake that size and that tasty. So it's they're like neck and neck for me.
It keeps coming up.
I'm going to get fat this summer.
We're so delighted that everybody talks about Fadley's because we absolutely love Miss Nancy Devine, who created the Jumbo Lump Crab Cake, and Damie Hahn, just doing great work over there waiting for the new Fadley's. And the other thing, before we get too serious, little did I had no idea, Justin, until this week, that Peter Jensen had such an amazing impact on your career and was actually the reason for all of your success until I read Jensen's op-ed. I mean, how did we not know that Jensen was your muse that inspired all this?
You know, it just we've been sitting near each other the past couple of years, and I it just rubbed off. Yeah,
it's absolutely what was nice of him. You know, he's a pretty shy guy, but he came out and he took credit. He took credit for you. He took credit for Francis McDormand and David Simon and Laura Lippman. So who knew that Jensen had that kind of sway, huh?
It's the Jensen effect. Yep.
Well, with that aside, I always say, where do we start? And I actually have talked to some friends who have covered this story as well, the Gun Trace Task Force. And where I start is part of your book that reads, in all, 8 members of the Gun Trace Task Force had been sentenced to federal prison. Jenkins for 25 years, Herschel and Terrell for 18, Allers for 15, Rahom for 12, Gondo for 10, Hendricks and Ward for 7, 7 other current or former officers, including the one-time commissioner, had been charged with federal crimes. Justin, let Nestor and I, could we assume, and not everybody knows this story, let Nestor and I get out of the way a little bit and have you assume for a moment that
and I'm sitting on a plane with you,
right,
and you tell me you're writing a book. And I'm like, what are you writing about?
What are you writing about?
You're not going to believe this story.
Yeah. So tell, how do you summarize, what's the Four Dummies version of the, and we're going to get into a lot of details. As I said, this is going to be a two-part interview. But in part one, describe for folks driving around out there. I love what Nestor said. What's the book about?
Yeah. I mean, so the Gun Trace Task Force corruption scandal involved a unit of plainclothes officers. And that's different from undercover. They're not like assuming different identities or anything like that. But they're officers who wear, you know, jeans and vests, and they ride around in unmarked cars and doing proactive policing, as it's called. And these officers were robbing people. They were stopping people without justification. They were inventing probable cause and, you know, doing searches using GPS devices. Some of the officers were taking drugs off the street and reselling them. And what the book tries to do is put this in its context of our sort of battle, both with crime in the city and our battle with an ethical police department. You know, these things go hand in hand in a lot of ways. And one of the shocking and heartbreaking things about the story is that this scandal was uncovered post Freddie Gray at a time where, you know, the Justice Department had come in, they'd done a civil rights review of the agency, they had documented things that were going on that shouldn't, and they were charting a path forward. And this was going on under their nose. This was going on despite all that, you know, at a time where you thought that everybody might have straightened their backs a little bit and been on their best behavior. And it points to, you know, what officers who are so inclined to do this kind of stuff are capable of if left to, if sort of not properly supervised, and the agency's sort of zeal to combat crime and not asking the right questions or doing the proper oversight. So it wraps up really 15 years of the agency's history. I covered the department for much of that time, and I chart the story through the leader of the Gun Trace Task Force, Wayne Jenkins, and the shifting strategies in the department, the scandals that arose, what he was up to leading up to this point. There's also a lot of information about the Freddie Gray case and about the mysterious death of Detective Sean Souter. So that's the airplane version of it.
Let's start at the beginning then for you. You're a crime reporter. How many cops you know? You know what I mean? Like Dick Irwin, who maybe you knew. Did you know Dick?
Absolutely. Okay. I sat next to him. Yeah.
Well, it is.
I was a pallbearer at the funeral.
Dick was like a father figure to me. Dick and I went to the Allegheny River and ate his favorite pie and got thrown off at Dimple Rock in 1987 when I was 19 years old and went to the Dairy Queen. I was at Dick's, the memorial for Dick at the bar in South Baltimore, Ford Avenue. So you and I might have been in the same
room. I was there, yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. Pool tables, some shrimp cocktail in the corner.
And I think David Simon jumped up on the bar at some point, or maybe that was
But Dick, you know, I worked every night with Dick, David Simon, Rafael Alvarez, you know, working at the Evening Sun doing Agate and rock and roll in the late 80s. And Dick would literally come over, you know, as he would do. He'd sit down, put his glasses in, and he'd say, the perpetrator was male, African-American, mid-20s. You know, he would just start to go into the Joe Friday story, you know. And I'm thinking, like, that was police beat, and he knew cops. I mean, Dick and David Simon made a living knowing cops. How many cops did you know in the modern era? I mean, be like, you ask me about football players. I used to know them all. Now I don't know any of them. You know what I mean? And trying to report on people and knowing them and looking for sources and information. You know, I don't know your job anymore. I probably knew more about it in 1988.
It is. So there's definitely officers I know. I wouldn't say it's a, you know, there's, it's an agency of 2,500. There's a lot of turnover. It's hard to keep up with it. I you know, when my first several years on the beat, I sort of prided myself in knowing who was in charge of everything. And these days, there's so much turnover that over the years, cumulatively, it's hard to keep up with it. But I do know officers, and it's crucial. It's crucial to understanding police work. It's crucial to uncovering things that aren't going correctly. I mean, you can't be outside the institution and expect to get stuff that's buried deep inside of it. And so, you know, you hear a lot about, you know, in the Trump era, you know, access journalism and stuff. And it's like, I bristle at that description of it because it's like, you have to be engaged with the people, you know, in the institution. It's just a matter of how you know, whether you, that causes you to turn a blind eye to something or causes you to have feelings about something. It's like, you know, and that's the challenge of being a journalist, is keep staying objective, digging into stuff, but being able to talk to people. And so, there's plenty of officers that in the course of this book, I sort of re-engaged with people that I had known in the past, people I know now, and met some new people as well. Just trying to get that insight to bring that out to people so they can understand how something like this goes on.
So when do you get a whiff of this? You know, and then like, you know, people clearly, these people that went to prison, this was a closed society. Other people weren't to know about it. But I think the most disgraced people in all of this are the other officers who sort of follow the rules and have been a part of the institution for 30 years, where this reflects upon who knew what, where, and when. And as a reporter, and I know when it comes to things with the Ravens or the Orioles in my job, they don't want me to know anything.
Right. So the plainclothes culture is one that I did not have a lot of insight into, because at the Sun, at the paper, you know, we're writing about homicides. We're writing about policy, what the commissioner and the other white shirts are saying at City Hall and stuff like that. We're doing coverage of shootings. We're doing, you know, neighborhood trend stories. You know, the plainclothes guys were definitely the source of the most complaints with the agency. And that was something that we'd written about for sure. But in terms of like our day-to-day coverage, it didn't put me, you know, these guys work in the shadows. They work in that gray area. They're the ones getting drugs and guns. And those weren't the cases we usually wrote about. So I some of the officers were known to me in the sense that, you know, one of the officers, Daniel Herschel, we'd written a ton about him having lawsuits and misconduct complaints. It was not a secret. He'd been written about a lot. Jamel Rayum had been involved with three shootings in the first 20 months that I was on the beat. And I've written about that.
Justin, I was struck by that.
Let me just finish this.
Go ahead.
I didn't know the rest of the guys, even Jenkins himself, that his name meant nothing to me. So this indictment kind of falls out of the sky again in this period where things are supposed to be getting better. And all of a sudden this indictment drops and it's like, what is the Gun Trace Task Force? and you Google it and you see their newsletter where they're praising them for getting guns, 100 guns off the street in an 8-month period. But that was not a section of the agency that I was familiar with. So anyway, go ahead.
No. Your point about the shooting, who was it? Rayham, we lost you there for a second, I think.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, yep, I'm okay, getting calls. I'm sorry about that.
No, it's good. It's good.
It's probably going to happen again.
It was Rayham, right, who shot three people in 20 months?
Right.
Yeah, so when I read that part of the book, and again, I'm taking notes, I'm thinking to myself, and you actually allude to it in the book, I've known many, many police officers, have terrific respect for them over the years, both when I worked on the school system side and then obviously on the government side and then as county executive. And almost to a man or woman, every officer, my cousin was a major in the state police. Every officer that I've ever known has never fired their weapon once, usually from the time they go on the force until they retire. I don't think my cousin ever fired his gun at the state. And I read three times in 20 months. Was that a red flag for you? I mean, when you were covering Rayham, you're going, that's an awful lot of shootings.
I mean, yeah, there were state legislators who called at the time for there to be an FBI outside investigation, that, you know, the NAACP had raised a concern. At the same time, the department viewed, very much at that time viewed, shootings. This is a not funny story, but an interesting thing. So around 2009, I want to say, the police department wanted to stop naming officers who shoot people, which today, you know, seems unfathomable that they would even try that. But they stopped identifying officers who shot people. And then I went to a department award ceremony. So they call everybody in and they sit them in this auditorium and they give out awards. Almost everybody who got an award had shot somebody. It was seen as a mark of bravery and courage. And you know, in a lot of cases, it might be. You know, you're engaging a dangerous person and you have to fire your weapon. And so people were getting awarded for that. So, I mean, you know, and Rayham himself was. He was one of the people who got an award. And it was ironic because they didn't want to name the officers. And yet I covered the award ceremony where they all got named for doing great things. And Rayham was one of them. So,
yeah. No, I think you allude to, you highlighted in the book on the night you were there covering that award ceremony, I think they gave out 24 commendations. 18 of them had to do with officers that had shot someone.
Yeah.
So
Justin, as a dude who pays taxes here, and like I take this picture out my window, I live here, right? You know, this is my home. I mean, if I'm sitting there at the police accommodation, right? You know, if I'm there as a reporter and my background's in reporting, Don's the PR side. I'm the journalism side. Somewhere in the middle, we get through the murky water and get the sunshine. But, you know, I've sat at those press conferences where I've been lied to and been – I mean, I had to mug John Angelos to ask a question about the Orioles at a press conference because they threw me out 16 years ago. I'm wondering how you get into the – you know what I mean? When they're telling you we don't want to tell you this and then open the door when you come in, that's sloppy policing, you know, for you to have access to that. I'm trying to figure out where the edges of the Dick Irwin and the David Simon and you get the nose up to go after this in the same way that, you know, somebody asked me recently about the paper and Save Our Son, said you used to not like the paper back in the 90s when you left after being there. And I said, you know, when you win Pulitzers and bring down mayors and expose things that citizens need to know about, that's what made me proud to go to work there in 1986. You know, when I got a job there at 17, it makes me proud to be an alum, you know, and talk about people like Dick Irwin, because everybody in that building when I was there wanted to get to the truth. And yeah, F the Sun, the Sun lies. I remember the guy that stood out. They're right. They're left wing. They're right wing. Whatever they are, it's necessary. And I can't begin to think how far the police force would go and the union to keep you and anybody like you, and only a couple people like you, only a couple people really sniffing the truth out, to keep you away from one of those accommodation award things, right? Where you get to meet real cops who shot people.
Yeah. I mean, in that instance, you know, you're as a beat reporter, you know, you're saying like, why would you not let me cover something where you're going to reward people for their good work? And so, you know, that was something where, yeah, they did let me in. It happened to conflict entirely with their strategy at that time on releasing those names. But I mean, yeah, that's the push and pull of doing the job. And there's been a real rise. You talk about PR. I mean, there's been a real rise in the PR apparatus where it's like, it used to be more, you know, here's the public information, here's what you need to know. And with the rise of social media and the decline of media, you know, you get more corporate PR. You get a lot more in-house produced videos, I'll never forget, I'm not going to name him, but one of the spokesmen was like, we don't need you anymore. He's like, we have a bigger reach on our social media. We do not need you, and we are going to cut you off. And, you know, what do you say to that, other than, you know, I'm getting information for taxpayers, for the public, I'm asking the questions you don't want to answer. And like, you know, I don't care what the metrics say, if that's even true, I dispute his metrics, but you know, I said, like, you know, you're, you know, we're still here, and we're going to be here. And it's very difficult. I say this a lot, but there's a meme that goes around every now and then about journalism, that it's not your job to quote people about whether it's raining outside. It's your job to stick your head out the window and say whether it's raining, and not quote two competing people with different viewpoints. But a lot of times people don't understand that reporting, there's no window. It's a brick wall. I don't know what's on the other side. And all I can do is talk to the police department, say what, you know, tell us your account. And I don't ever consider that account to be the gospel. I understand how that gets interpreted by readers, that we're trying to push their line or something, but I've always saw it as getting people on the record. You know, this is what your government says. And if we find out that it's not true, or someone sees that and wants to challenge it, we're going to print that too. Oftentimes, though, it's the follow-up is difficult. There's all these systems in place that prevent it. And, you know, it's just, I'm not going to sit here and say we, you know, get it right. We're trying, though. It's a constant process. So I hope that answers the question.
Oh, no. You know, I thought when you were saying that, we've had Pam Wood on a number of times, your outstanding government reporter there at The Sun. And she defines it this way. She says, what I was taught is, if your mother says, I love you, your first response to your mom is, prove it. You know, you don't take anything at face value. Prove it, Mom, that you love me. You know, we are with Justin Fenton, Sun paper reporter, crime reporter, author of an incredible new book, We Own This City. Run to your bookstore, run to your big box store, Amazon, wherever you get your books. But if you can support locally, do that. You will not put this book down. I did not put it down. It will disturb you, but it's a must read.
Justin, well, can do the PR for you, Justin.
Before we sort of move to wrap up segment one, because we're going to get into a lot of specifics in segment two, can you go again? I think people listening now, they have a sense. This was a group of men. It was interesting. No women, right? All men.
Right.
All men. I was struck by that, who really became their own little band of criminals, this 7 or 8 guys that were their own little band of criminals. We'll talk about some good guys who didn't go along because I was fascinated by that.
Yes.
But I mean, that was that, I mean, Kostopoulos and others that you write about, I mean, they come off as real heroes. I was very, very pleased that in terms of our Baltimore County police officers, they come off well. Yeah, in your book, you know, I kept every time I turned the page, I'm thinking, oh boy, please, please, please. And it was, oh, okay, the Baltimore County part would have a happy ending.
Well, you know what? Guys, I don't know. I don't know how they got caught. So that,
well, we're going to talk. We're
like, right. Talk, well, so this is, I still don't really know how they got caught.
Well, we're going to talk about all that. But before we get into the specifics, let's end segment one by having Justin go to 10,000 feet and tell us from 10,000 feet. What conclusions you draw now about urban policing? Was this an anomaly? What do we learn about our society now that you've covered this story for a number of years? 10,000 feet view, and then we'll wrap that up in part one.
Yeah, geez, that's a tough one. I mean, you know, again, the city is, you know, the different administrations and leadership, they are trying to drive down crime. You know, they don't do job training. They don't do dispute mediation. They're there to try to find people with guns, find people with drugs, and arrest them. And, you know, proactive policing is a very dangerous tool. I officers will tell you, I just did a podcast interview with two officers actually who hosted their own podcast. And you know, they say we have to have proactive policing. You have to be looking for it. Otherwise you're just, you know, you're responding to a fire and putting it out. We've got to make people think twice about heading out with a gun or carrying a gun on the street. And yet you see so many examples of how that goes wrong, where people who are minding their business, who you know, fit the profile or doing something that officers consider to be suspicious or you know, they've seen in the past someone who was doing this, and you see people getting harassed, and it creates this gulf. But if you do without it, you know, what's going to fill that in? And I think it's that's the question, like, of sounds cheesy. It's the question of our time. It's the $1 million right. question of how are we going to thread this needle? And those are continuing conversations. I think the city that is, it's not, there's nothing new about trying to consider how the city's funds are best spent, whether it's, you know, more for education and other areas. But I think, you know, I think our current administration is going to be considering that in a way that maybe hasn't been in the past. And we'll see what happens on, you know.
Great, great place to come back when we jump into part two. But you just mentioned staying at that 10, and I do want to talk about the current administration, whether or not you think the mayor can make a difference, whether you think this commissioner's up to the challenge. But when you talked about the great dilemma, what kind of policing do we need? We do want us to be safe. One of the things, Justin, before we wrap this up in this part, that I kept being struck by, and I would comment to my wife and see if I'm wrong on this. I would say, you know what makes this so hard? What makes this a challenging read is that these guys, Wayne Jenkins and his crew, they're bad guys. They're Tony Soprano types. They're gangsters, no doubt about it. But on the flip side, the guys they were always targeting were also bad guys. They weren't the honor society, right? I mean, these were guys selling drugs, selling guns. They weren't targeting people who were winning awards for being members of the honor society. Is that accurate?
It's not accurate because okay. I think their targets for the big robberies were fit that description totally. Absolutely, they were not stealing $200,000 from somebody who was, you know, using it for legal reasons in most cases. But I think what I tried to show with all those traffic stops and what I was just alluding to with the proactive policing is they would head out and try to stop as many people as they could without justification and try to draw, you know, drive at people and then slam on their brakes and pop their doors open and see who runs and pulling people over based on, you know, seatbelt violation. You know, people who had driven 5 feet off of a gas pump are getting pulled over for not having their seatbelt on and their car searched. There's a guy who was eating lunch in the middle of the day and they searched his car because he's parked, you know, 4 feet from the curb. I mean, stuff like that. And so it's on different tracks for sure. But in the end, it helps explain sort of the alienation out there.
Oh, without a Nestor, I know you want part two, right? This is just
I want to get to the genesis of like how this thing becomes a book and a story. Justin Fenton is here. We Own the City is the book, a true story of crime, cops, and corruption, of course, in the Baltimore Sun. Don Moeller's my co-host. We're going to step out and do what we don't often do. Take a break in the middle of one of these segments because we're about to get juicy with the full story with Justin Fenton. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking Baltimore positive.